Let's go ahead and open to Numbers chapter 34. And I want to start today by just summarizing the boundaries of the Promised Land as they are described in the first 11 verses there in chapter 34. I'm looking at my copy of Google Earth, which is very helpful when trying to visualize some of these things. If you start at the southern end of what used to be the full Dead Sea, it's a little bit harder to see nowadays because they've mined the waters and the chemicals in the southern portion of the Dead Sea quite a bit. But if you start at what used to be the southern end of the Dead Sea and go about 40 miles to the south and slightly deviating toward the west, you come to a modern community called Paran. It's not much more than a little agricultural station. That is where I believe Kadesh Barnea was located. So that's the southeast end of the Israeli border by the Promised Land standards. Now, if you follow the wadi from Kadesh Barnea uphill, you come up to a point where there's a watershed break, a place where instead of water draining into the Gulf of Aqaba, it drains into the Mediterranean. So that's about 30-some miles to the west, and it's right near this great big land feature where you've got a big depression that is long and kind of narrow. It looks a little bit like a crater, but it actually isn't an impact crater of any sort. It's just a geographical depression, perhaps something left over from the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. But at that point, when you start going downhill again toward the west and following the wadi, you get on what's called in Scripture the River of Egypt, which is confusing to some because they think that means the Nile, but it doesn't. It means the Wadi al-Arish, which drains the northern Sinai into the southeast corner of the Mediterranean. And I think I said yesterday that this wadi dumps out near Gaza. I was totally wrong with that. That's a different one that I conflated with this. The Wadi al-Arish dumps out at a community called today Arish. And so that would have been the western portion of the southern border for Canaan and therefore for the Promised Land. From there, you just follow the coastline north until you get right around Tyre. Now, Tyre was an independent city which God told the Israelis they needed to respect as an independent city. So the border would have wrapped around Tyre, just a few miles, maybe 10 miles or so to the north, and from there it would have gone due east toward Mount Hermon. And so this line is going to take you across to the entrance of Hamath, which is a place just north of Dan, where the valley around the Jordan comes to an end and some higher hills kind of close in around the upper Jordan. And that path eventually goes way far north, about 120-some miles to the north, to a community called Hamath. So this is the southern entrance point to that long valley. And it's just a few miles north of Dan. I'm trying to think about how far it is. It's I think it's less than 10 miles. But that would be the northern border. I know that many of your Bible maps make it farther north than that. And I think the reason that that happened is because some of the names much farther north in the Middle East share names with communities that were down here closer to the Sea of Galilee. And that, I think, is where the confusion comes in. So effectively, a little bit north of Tyre, you follow a line eastward until you hit the foothills of Mount Hermon. And then it follows a line probably past what we call Banias today, what was Caesarea Philippi. It's another one of the sources of the Jordan. It just comes out from a great big bare spot, a big rocky cliff. And that is probably where it now follows the Jordan south until it gets to the northeast corner of the Sea of Galilee. And it says that in the text, that you come to the shoulder of the Sea of Kinnereth. Now, Kinnereth in Hebrew means a harp. And so the Sea of Galilee is harp-shaped. They understood that. And so that's why it had this name. So the northeast shoulder is where now the border follows along the eastern shore of the sea, and then it joins the Jordan River, and it follows it all the way down to the Dead Sea, and then it follows the Dead Sea's eastern shoreline until it reaches the first place that was listed on the southern end of the Dead Sea. And so that was the original promised land. And that is the territory which will be divided up by lot among the tribal members. And that's where we read in Numbers chapter 34, verse number 13. Moses commanded the people of Israel, saying, "This is the land that you shall inherit by lot, which he who is has commanded to give to the nine tribes and to the half tribe. For the tribe of the people of Reuben by fathers' houses, and the tribe of the people of Gad by their fathers' houses have received their inheritance, and also the half tribe of Manasseh. The two tribes and the half tribe have received their inheritance beyond the Jordan, east of Jericho, toward the sunrise." So Moses says only 9.5 tribes have to divide up the promised land, because the other 2.5 tribes have already taken possession at the in the annexed eastern territories with God's permission, provided they become part of the military vanguard that takes the promised land. So everybody knows that within a short time, the land will be divided up. Now, the Levites, though, they don't get a region themselves. Instead, they are going to be scattered into communities, divided up within the tribes, so that they can provide spiritual Levitical support to the tribes, even away from the tabernacle. Because the tabernacle is going to be located in a central location, and everybody will be coming to it at the regular meetings, like Passover and Pentecost and Feast of Tabernacles. But the rest of the time, they will do their worship and their fellowship in their own community regions. And so the Levites, including the priests eventually, are going to be living among the Israelis and providing that spiritual support. That's the concept that is in mind. Now, they're going to have a hard time because of sinfulness following through with it, but that is the concept. Chapter 35. He who is spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho, saying, "Command the people of Israel to give to the Levites some of the inheritance of their possession as cities for them to dwell in. You shall give to the Levites pasture lands around the cities. The cities shall be theirs to dwell in, and their pasture lands shall be for their cattle and for their livestock and for all their beasts." So they're going to be designated inside each tribe specific Levitical cities that will belong to the Levites, not to any of the members of the tribe nearby. And it's not just simply the city with its walls that will belong to the Levites. So will some of the area around it to be used for agriculture and for running of animals. So verse number 4, "The pasture lands of the cities, which you shall give to the Levites, shall reach from the wall of the city outward 1,000 cubits all around. You shall measure outside the city on the east side 2,000 cubits, and on the south side 2,000 cubits, and on the west side 2,000 cubits, on the north side 2,000 cubits, the city being in the middle. This shall belong to them as pasture lands for their cities. So 2,000 cubits from the wall outward, apparently, is going to be using the long cubit, which I do, which is 20.7 inches, is 3,450 feet. So that's 0.65 miles. So this is a pretty good bit of agricultural and grazing land around each of these cities. It's certainly enough that the Levites living inside those cities can see to their own needs as they are living among the people of Israel. Now, they're going to be still supported by tithes, but they will be using those tithes to kind of plant and also to raise animals on their own. And then they will be tithing in order to support the priests. The cities that you give to the Levites, verse 6, the six cities of refuge where you shall permit the manslayer to flee. Now, we haven't talked about that yet. That's coming up. And in addition to them, you shall give them 42 cities. So you've got six cities of refuge, and then 42 Levitical cities. So that's 48 cities all together. So that's 24 times 2, which is interesting because you've got 12 months in the year, and then 12 times 2 is 24, and then 24 times 2 is 48. So there's some reasonableness to the numbers that are showing up here. And the reason for starting with the 12 there is because when David is designing the temple that Solomon will build, he, at God's inspired direction, makes it where the tribe, the Levites and the priests are divided up into 24 courses each, 24 units, and each of them is going to come and serve for 1 week at a time, which means they're going to serve two times each year plus the holiday times. But the rest of their days will be spent in their Levitical cities doing local work. So that's all starting right here. David just kind of fine-tunes it at the Spirit's direction. Verse number, verse number seven. All the cities that you give to the Levites shall be 48 with their pasture lands. And as for the cities that you shall give for the possession of the people of Israel, from the larger tribes, they shall take many. From the smaller tribes, they shall take few. In proportion to the inheritance that it inherits, shall give of its cities to the Levites. So the tribal groups that have larger territory and therefore more cities are expected to have more Levitical cities inside their territory than the smaller tribes, which have fewer cities in them. They'll only have a couple probably in order to have the Levites nearby. When it's all said and done, pretty much everyone lives within a few hours' walk of the Levites. That will be the ultimate goal. Verse number 9. He who is spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall select cities of cities of refuge for you, that the manslayer who kills any person without intent may flee there. The cities shall be for you a refuge from the avenger, that the manslayer may not die until he stands before the congregation for judgment. Now, the idea here is when somebody accidentally kills someone else, now it might even be that they're angry and they meant to hurt the person, but they accidentally go too far and kill the person. The local people where that event happens are probably in the emotion of the moment going to want to execute the person for causing the death of the other. So what is needed is for cooler heads to judge the situation. So God has designed it here where there are going to be specific cities of refuge, meaning they're within less than a day's travel from any person living in the Promised Land. That if you did accidentally kill someone, you could immediately take off to the city of refuge and be guaranteed a fair trial. So that the emotion of the moment wouldn't necessarily end up not taking in consideration circumstances. So it says in verse 13, the cities that you shall give shall be six cities of refuge. You shall give three cities beyond the Jordan, so three cities on the east side, and three cities in the land of Canaan to be cities of refuge. These six cities shall be for refuge for the people of Israel and for the stranger and for the sojourner among them, that anyone who kills another person without intent may flee there. So the guarantee is these cities are protected zones where anybody that goes there is guaranteed you will have a trial in front of people that are not involved in the community where the event took place. That's the guarantee. More than likely, it's going to be Levites or priests that are going to be particularly on the jury. Now we get into some specifics as to what we're talking about here about accidents and accidental murder, or not murder, but manslaughter. Verse 16, if he struck him down with an iron object so that he died, he is a murderer. Now, why is that? Because the assumption is if you picked up something made out of forged metal, you should have known that that would cause a fatal injury if used against that person. So it's getting into the mind of the person that's committing the act. You should have known better because of what it was made from. The murderer shall be put to death. If he struck him down with a stone tool that could cause death and he died, he is a murderer. So if you've got like some sort of axe that's a piece of wood with a stone axe on the top of it, and you smack somebody with that, that is a deadly instrument. So you should have known better than using that. And that makes you guilty. Verse 18, or if he struck him down with a wooden tool that could cause death and he died, he is a murderer. So if you've got a tool such as made out of wood, like a hoe, that might have like a sharpened area on it, that should also be pretty obvious. So we're the people who are judging these are supposed to take this into consideration. What should the person have known when he did this? Did he realize this could have caused death? And so if you've got like an axe or a knife or some sort of sharp object, that should be pretty obvious to the person wielding it. You could kill this guy with it. You shouldn't have done anything against him. So verse number 19, the avenger of blood shall himself put the murderer to death. When he meets him, he shall put him to death. Now the avenger of blood is a local person who has been designated by the group to be the executioner. So he shows up from the local community where the event happened. He shows up with the neighbors and the friends and family of the person that was killed. And he shows up at the city of refuge. The trial takes place. And the judges decide, yes, this was murder. Then this guy, designated by his community, becomes the executioner. And that is legitimate. That is appropriate. It actually goes back to the book of Genesis, right around the time of the flood. He who sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. So that is the beginning of legitimate capital punishment. And so this Avenger Blood is not somebody that just is related to the guy that was killed, who's out there tracking this guy down to get vengeance. This is a community-designated agent. And let's keep that in mind. This is all on the up and up here. Verse number 20. If he pushed him out of hatred or hurled something against him, lying in wait that so that he died, or in enmity struck him down with his hand so that he died, then he who struck the blow shall be put to death. He is a murderer. The avenger of blood shall be put the murderer to death when he meets him. Now, when it talks here about pushing him, it means as in pushing him to kill him, like pushing him off a cliff. That's pretty clear. That's murder. You're hiding in the bushes, hiding in a tree so that you can jump down and break his neck. That's pretty clear. That's murder. So premeditation is what's kind of being brought out here in this section. Now, verse 22. But if he pushed him suddenly without enmity, or hurled something on him without lying in wait, or used a stone that could cause death without seeing him, dropped it on him so that he died, though he was not his enemy and did not seek his harm, then the congregation shall judge between the manslayer and the avenger of blood in accordance with these rules. So one of the best examples is you've got two guys, they're on a construction site. One guy's up on the wall, and he accidentally drops a concrete block, and it hits the other guy in the head, and I guess he must not have had his hard hat on. Probably wouldn't have mattered anyway, depending on how far the thing fell, but it kills him. Well, the guy that dropped it is going to feel really bad, and in this context, he would have run off to the city of refuge and had the trial, and then the congregational judges would say, no, it was an accident. So no, the Avenger of Blood may not execute this guy. Then let's see, where were we at? Verse number... I apologize. I just changed over to a different Bible because my computer crashed, so I'm looking... verse number 25. The congregation shall rescue the manslayer from the hand of the avenger, and the congregation shall restore him to his city of refuge to which he has fled, and he shall live in it until the death of the high priest who was anointed with the holy oil. Now, this is different than the way we do things today in our legal system. Today, if you are judged to be not guilty of a capital crime, meaning it was an accident, you didn't mean to kill the guy, then that's the end of the matter. But here, under the Israeli law, the idea that you caused somebody else's death, even by accident, was still a very serious thing, and feelings would be high back in the community where it happened. So the rule was, even if you were judged to be a manslayer by accident, you had to stay at the city of refuge and take up your life there until the high priest died, because there needed to be a calming down time. There needed to be a time where what you did was no longer fresh in the minds of the people. And it was so serious that this is what it says next. Verse 26, if the manslayer shall at any time go beyond the boundaries of his city of refuge to which he fled, and the avenger of blood finds him outside the boundaries of his city of refuge, and the avenger of blood kills the manslayer, he shall not be guilty of blood. For he must remain in his city of refuge until the death of the high priest. But after the death of the high priest, the manslayer may return to the land of his possession. These things shall be for a statute and rule for you throughout your generations in all your dwelling places. So you were effectively under city arrest or city detention. You had to stay there until the high priest passed. If you violated that agreement and you were found outside the boundaries, and the avenger, the official executioner, found you outside those boundaries and executed you, that was on you. Verse 30, if anyone kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death on the evidence of witnesses, but no person shall be put to death on the testimony of one witness. Moreover, you shall accept no ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death, but he shall be put to death. So you've got to have two or more witnesses. Now, it doesn't necessarily be eyewitnesses, I suppose. It has to be somebody who clearly saw evidence of the crime. And that evidence is weighed by the judges or the jury. And then you can't buy yourself out of this. If you're wealthy, you can't offer to pay for the death, because that would be inappropriate. So execution is the remedy for murder. Verse 32, you shall accept no ransom for him who has fled to his city of refuge, that he may return to dwell in the land before the death of the high priest. So you can't bribe your way out of the timing. You shall not pollute the land in which you live, for blood pollutes the land, and no atonement can be made for the land for the blood that was shed in it, except by the blood of the one who sheds it. And that gets back to the Genesis passage, Genesis chapter 9. He who sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. So if you murder someone, your life is forfeit. And that's the way it was supposed to be in Israeli society under this law. Verse 34, you shall not defile the land in which you live, in the midst of which I dwell, for I, he who is, dwell in the midst of the people of Israel. So God says, my land, my rules. And I say, you should not be murdering one another. That's part of the Ten Commandments. And when you do, your life is forfeit. You are executed. Even when you accidentally take someone's life, you need some time out. And you can't violate that also. Well, we're out of time for the day, so let's mark our places and get back together tomorrow into the Word.